This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck with you today, flying solo. It is my great pleasure to welcome a man who at just 32 was appointed the Director of Artistic Planning for one of Australia's most prized possessions, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. His name is Hugh Humphreys. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Dean.
Hugh, there's got to be a bit of background to you to get a job like that, surely?
Oh, you'd hope so, a little bit. Yeah, well, I'm from the UK. I've been in Melbourne 6 years now. And prior to the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, I was the general manager of a really phenomenal orchestra called the European Union Youth Orchestra, which unites players from across the 27 countries of the EU in three tours a year. We work with just phenomenal conductors and
what's
and
the age range of the...
It went up to about 24. I mean, it was nominally 14 to 24.
Wow.
But because the playing is such high quality, I mean, it was unusual for people to be in the orchestra before about the age of 21. There was a 14-year-old in it during my time who I last saw leading the second violins of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. You know, it's,
wow.
It was truly sort of phenomenal experience, that orchestra.
Was it difficult to manage these, and I don't mean it in a derogatory sense, these kids?
No, it was an absolute piece of cake. And
right.
The reason is that these guys, they met for three tours a year, so each tour was sort of 5 or 6 weeks. But during that time, that's all they were there to do. They were right. there solely to make music. If a rehearsal got cancelled or got shortened, they were disappointed because they just wanted to work. That's all they were, you know, they wanted to suck the marrow out of that experience.
I guess it's, for their age group, the most elite thing to aim for. And once they've got it, they want to continue on, you know, and take that next
Absolutely.
Step.
Absolutely. I mean, they all go into professional careers. And, you know, what's extraordinary out of, I was there for 4 years, but players who were in the orchestra in my time, there's the concertmaster of the Philharmonic Orchestra in London, the principal clarinet of the Concertgebouw, you know, they're you know, four or five players who now are in the Berlin Philharmonic, Vienna Philharmonic. It's staggering. And it was an intoxicating kind of period.
And I imagine so much so that inspirational for many that go through that.
Absolutely, and it's the opportunity to work with some truly extraordinary artists. And our chief conductor was Vladimir Ashkenazy, who's chief conductor in Sydney Symphony, but obviously has been with the MSO a couple of times. But also great artists like Sir John Elliott Gardiner, Bernard Haitink.
What do these guest conductors think of this young group of people?
They come to it really to be energized because
right, yeah.
they have a level of cooperation that they don't often get with the orchestra.
There's no ego there.
There is. The orchestra yeah. has. The orchestra does not say we've played this for the last 40 years this way.
Not that again.
Yeah, it's absolutely. What are you going to show us? And and you see these smiles on these sort of very eminent maestros' faces that they don't see with.
Yeah.
A lot of orchestras. It's a great experience.
I guess some of them let the guard down with the younger performers than they would with, an established orchestra.
They do, and for some people, it's an opportunity to try things out. It's an opportunity to experiment, because the orchestra is so flexible in what they do.
Yeah, it's a malleable
thing,
yeah.
And so it's, and you know, it's the main tour is over the summer months. We visited some extraordinary places. We were residents, because we'd have to start with a three-week residency wherever we were, and those were in some pretty extraordinarily beautiful places. My last one was in Porto. We were often based in this small alpine resort called Bolzano, which is sort of between Germany and Italy. You know, and the whole spirit of the weeks made for really memorable times.
How many were in a touring group for the European Union?
So there'd be
an
orchestra of 140, which is a huge logistical...
That's crazy.
An orchestra of 140 and a staff of 7. You know, that was a big deal.
That's it's a ratio that they wouldn't let teachers and kids on an excursion, that sort of ratio.
Players of that level are pretty responsible. I mean, the most common complaint we ever had at hotels with them is, well, they stop practicing in the rooms. You know, it wasn't the case that, you know, late night parties were not that usual. It was more, you know, turn that tuba player off on the 15th floor because we've got complaints. Yeah.
What an extraordinary experience for you.
It was, and leading it was, it was, as I said before, it was like being a kid in a sweet shop, because you're working with a level of musician and a level of music making which you don't find often without several sacrifices.
Prior to that, you worked for a touring company that managed Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, Boston Symphony Orchestra, San Francisco Symphony, and somehow managed to fit in your master's in music from Oxford University.
No, I did my degrees between 18 and 21, and then I started work in this company, which was initially which created a lot of smiles for many Australians. It was called Harold Holt Limited, and I had no idea what the joke was at that time.
Indeed,
and Harold Holt, who died sort of 60, 70 years ago, was one of the UK's greatest impresarios.
You're Harold Holt.
Yes.
Yes.
But of course, you know, if you'd ring up the local off-licence wanting to order some wine for the party that the company was about to have, and you'd say, I'm ringing from Harold Holt Limited, and, you know, the Aussie who was doing his work experience there would just snigger down the phone at you and, you know, said, have they found him then? You know, so, yeah, and I went on to work in the touring division, and I had the great privilege, really, of touring with many of the world's great orchestras, fixing up their tours, going on the tours, administrating them.
Were the kids easier to manage?
Well, there was more infrastructure around a professional orchestra, so I was...
That's a very political answer.
Yeah, I mean, so I didn't have to do much management of the players at that time. It was more making sure that arrangements that we'd made had worked out, but I had this experience, particularly going on tour, as the tour managers, you go into a location, you know, it could be the Royal Albert Hall in London, and you're there at 6:30 in the morning to watch the loading, and you are literally one of five or six people in the venue, and you just stay there all day, and you watch as the instruments come in, the stage gets set up, the rehearsal takes place, the microphones go in, the orchestra go out on a break, the audience come in, and suddenly you've got showtime. And I've always really retained that as a very magical experience, watching the whole day unfold. And I find a real magic in empty concert halls as well as full ones.
It's one of the fascinations that I've always had of what goes on behind the scenes, whether it be radio or television or theatre or indeed the orchestra. But you're right, that whole setup to bloom... Yeah. Is an extraordinary experience, and we are spoilt as an audience member because we only see the bloom.
Yeah.
We don't see the bud.
And well, that's show business. Yeah. you know, you see the swan swimming on the surface, but you don't see the feet furiously paddling underneath.
Indeed. Or hopefully not.
Hopefully not, exactly.
Yeah. Now, your evolution as a arts administrator, why have you chosen that path rather than maybe a performer?
Well, I'd say when I left school at 18, I had sort of two career paths that I could have gone down, and I had a place at the Royal College of Music in London. I played piano and violin and conducted, and I had a place to read music at Oxford University, and I wanted to go to university. It's quite different in the UK than it is in Australia, in that if you want to play an instrument, you go to a music college.
Right.
If you want to study music and musicology, which is what I did, you go to university. And there's a much greater differentiation.
So one focuses on the fine art and the other focuses, I guess, on a bit of history.
Well, it's more one is a practical degree.
Right.
And the other, you know, what I did was history of music, techniques of composition, yep. Musicology, theory, orchestration, all of these. It was a very dry academic course, but actually that suited me, because sure. One thing that I wasn't terribly good at was handling nerves prior to performances, and I get nervous. Oh, okay. And I would be very calm in my head, but actually my right hand would start shaking. And if you're a violinist, if your right hand starts shaking, it don't sound too good.
So, and that was an uncontrollable reflex.
Yeah, and right. It would calm down after about 5 minutes, but ultimately I didn't want my degree sure. to be dependent on
the first five minutes.
how my nerves were that day.
But to be in arts administration, particularly in this country, it's a very small pool of talent.
It is.
And they circulate and go from one arena to the next. It's highly competitive. And it means that you have to not only be good at programming, but you have to liaise with funders, you have to be excellent in the marketing of the product, you have to work in with the organisational structure, manage the politics. It is a nightmare on wheels. Why did you go down this path?
I wouldn't describe it as a nightmare on wheels. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I enjoy diplomacy. That human interaction side of things. I mean, one thing that you might think by the title of my job, Director of Artistic Planning, is that I sit in a room all day and dream up programs and, you know, kind of then open the door and go, I've done it, I've got it. But, you know, that's about sort of 10, 15 minutes of my day when I've got the peace and quiet. And it's often at sort of 5:30 in the morning to actually think without the distractions of the rest of the day,
the marketing, the organizational structures, the funding, the
well, I mean, we have very specialist people in marketing and development and all those things, but
you still have to
know what I do, how that relates to each of my colleagues' jobs, but you know, it's actually the variety of the job is one of the things that keeps me really excited about it, because what's fascinating at the moment is, say, just right at this moment, the end of October 2011. So there's a little bit of my head that's existing in October 2011. What's the concert tomorrow night? It's Mozart in Town Hall.
Last night you were in Geelong.
Friday night we were in Geelong. Last night we were in Town Hall. So who's the conductor? Is he happy? Well, the soloists, is it going well? How's the interaction going with the orchestra? You know, it's a very present set of challenges and set of things to think about. Then there's 2012 season. That's on sale. It's been released. It's been released since August. Then another part of my head is in 2013 and 2014, where I'm doing advanced planning at the moment. So I exist in all of these different time zones.
They're they're like parallel universes.
They are, absolutely. But you also have to remember how each one relates, because, you know, I've really got to be able to hold in my head what pieces of music we're programming at any particular time.
This is Word for Word, Dean Beck with you, and my guest is Hugh Humphreys, Director of Artistic Planning for Melbourne's Symphony Orchestra. Hugh, what's the difference between a Director of Artistic Planning and an Artistic Director?
It's a very sort of blurry line at the moment, particularly as the MSO doesn't have a chief conductor and artistic director at the moment.
I was going to get to that. So, where does the chief conductor fit into that equation?
Well, a chief conductor, some are called chief conductor, some are called principal conductor, some are called artistic director, some are called music director. And what they do in every orchestra is slightly different. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt that without a chief conductor in place for the MSO at the moment, although that search process is an ongoing priority for the MSO, you know, a lot of that programming responsibility falls onto me, which is a privilege and an honour, really.
Indeed, indeed. And it's where I was sort of going earlier with that whole being the face or the marketing face of an organisation such as this. More often than not, it's that principal conductor that's pushed forward and is the spokesperson, yeah. I guess. Well, it's something that you've taken on board.
To a certain extent, but actually what we've really done in the last 2 years is put the orchestra and the orchestra members front and centre.
Do things like these fantastic educational programs that give a bit of background to those who want to find out more about what's coming up.
And we'll continue to do that. And, you know, I really enjoy doing talks and presentations and lectures, whatever you call them, because, I mean, going back to what we were discussing earlier, it allows me to kind of reconnect with my university days a bit. And actually, you know, there was a bit of me that liked being in the library, looking up facts and figures and researching. And, you know, some days you can feel disconnected from the music, and that is something, that's why we do this job. It's a love of music, and I think I have a quality in me that wants people to love the music that I love. I really do feel that spreading that gospel is vitally important.
It gives a greater depth to the understanding of the program, but I think it also helps to provide a longevity within your audience if they feel connected to the brand of Melbourne
Absolutely.
Symphony Orchestra.
That's a very interesting question, Dean. One really interesting point, I think, is every year when we announce our season, the first series that sells out is our chamber music series, which is Sunday mornings. It's a small hall. It's 400 seats, and we do four Sunday mornings in a year. But I think a lot of that is
to do
with...
You mean it's not the big rock concerts?
No, but I think a part of the reason for that is that the concerts are held in the Iwaki Auditorium, which is the MSO's rehearsal venue, and people come in almost to a private side of the MSO, and they feel connected by being in the venue where we rehearse.
It's the intimacy of it all.
It's an intimacy and an informality, actually, that you don't get in Hamer Hall or Melbourne Town Hall, which is, you know, very much
us and them,
and there's a barrier. And but we're also looking at lots of ways at deconstructing that barrier at the moment. I mean, people might have seen we're launching a new season coming up, or a new series, and there'll be a couple of concerts in November, and it's called Secret Symphony, and this is being launched solely over Twitter and Facebook, and we're going to do a series of unannounced concerts, or they'll be announced and information
very controversial
drip fed to the audience, but there'll be a late night there, and there'll be an intimate experience that is beyond what is traditionally the symphony orchestra presentation.
Is that your idea?
That one was myself and my team. We put that together.
That's pretty cutting edge in its pitch. It could be fantastic or bomb. And are you prepared to take that risk?
Absolutely. If we don't risk, we don't grow. You know, similarly with our repertoire, if we continue to present, you know, the favourite classics concert after concert after concert, sadly, eventually people will go, well, I heard Beethoven 5 last year, I don't need to hear it this year. And then actually you're worrying about your war horses.
But doesn't that give you, to a degree, a safety net of audience members? Doesn't playing those classics year in, year out bring back an audience that loves to hear those things?
It does. I think the most important thing is that you can perform standard repertoire
and you know, that's a horrible expression, standard repertoire, but you can perform this repertoire. What you mustn't ever do is perform it in a standard manner. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even with these great pieces. I mean, I think one of the great successes of our Beethoven Festival, which for us was truly exceeded our wildest dreams in August this year, was the performances were unlike performances that the Melbourne audience had heard recently. They were done in a much more historical style. The sound was much thinner and sparser. It was less, it was more transparent, and it had an energy that just communicated from stage to audience that was spectacular. And as a result, the festival grew and grew and grew. And one of the things we're proudest of at the MSO was that this cycle of five programs, there were 400 people who bought tickets for the whole cycle, so bought tickets across the board, who had never been to an MSO concert before.
That's special.
400 people, that's a lot, who were prepared to go to five concerts inside 2 weeks. And there's a little bit of us that's thinking, how come we hadn't communicated to these before? So maybe our Secret Symphony series, which you can sort of access the initial clues to on Facebook and Twitter, maybe that's going to create a new momentum and going to resonate with people for whom, you know, the subscription model that we've traditionally operated in isn't the way that they want to experience music.
I had the great privilege of seeing Melbourne Symphony Orchestra at the Melbourne Town Hall about 4 or 5 weeks ago. And there was a new piece featured by a Chinese-born Australian artist.
Yes.
That I loved. I spoke to Sarah Kuro, one of your violinists. Yes. She said it was difficult to perform. It sounded extraordinary. And is that a piece that you went out to commission, or was it on the table as a new Australian piece? And you,
the MSO commissioned that piece. So right. Julian Yu, the composer, is of Chinese origin. He's been based in Melbourne for some time. He teaches at Melbourne University. He's a He's an important voice in Australian composition. And it was a piece that we went out commissioned, but we were careful to present it in a manner that would achieve the best audience that we could. So it was performed alongside Elgar's, you know, very popular cello concerto. So people would come for the Elgar, also hear the U. That's crucial, that we are guardians of an art form, and not just guardians, because that sounds that you're protecting something, and you're not necessarily protecting it, something you're driving forward. You are expanding the repertoire. That's a crucial part of our mission, and it's a crucial responsibility of why we receive funding.
Indeed. In fact, your funding is mainly through government sources, both state and federal.
And city,
indeed, City of Melbourne. You have a couple of major corporates, but ultimately it's about bums on seats. It's about getting people through the door. And if you don't do that, you will quickly find yourself redundant. It's happened to many opera companies, and sadly it may happen to some of our orchestras as well before too long. Is doing things like, let's look at next year's program, West Side Story, Lord of the Rings, getting human nature through the door to perform a Christmas program, is that the cream on the top, or is that about broadening the audience? Why do you do these big, I guess, popular
things? West Side Story, the project that we're doing next year, it's the 50th anniversary of the award-winning, Oscar-winning film. And so this project that we do has the film shown live in Hamer Hall with a live orchestra. Now, West Side Story is one of the most, really, the most important scores of the 20th century in its remarkable combination of music and ballet. And song. And so, I mean, that for me is a very sort of easy project to say. It works on so many levels. But, you know, we are the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. We need to communicate to as many people in Melbourne as possible. And if that is working with human nature for, you know, it's that's 1 week of our year. And you can massively overplay the amount of commercial programming that we do. I mean, it's a limited, it's probably 4 or 5 weeks a year. In some ways, the commercial success that we can achieve in those concerts also can be driven towards some of our loftier artistic ambitions as well.
It balances it out.
Absolutely.
And broadens your scope. Does it piss off some of your traditionalists?
No, because we don't...
There's no crossover.
We don't put human nature into the master series. So it's not like we're saying this is absolutely part of your Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich and Beethoven for the season. It's something quite different and totally valid. And yeah, with that human nature show, this is the third time we'll have worked with them. So that's actually a sign that there is a collaboration there that really works. Mm. And this is a show that we're commissioning as well. So it's a Christmas show, it's a family show, and people will hear an orchestral sound in the run-up to Christmas. That's kind of crucially important.
We're speaking with Hugh Humphreys, Director of Artistic Planning at Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. You have recently launched the 2012 season, Hugh. Let's give it a bit of a profile.
Well, the centrepiece of the 2012 season is the return to Hamer Hall in August. You know, that's returning home after 2 years at Melbourne Town Hall.
How's the experience been at the being in the Town Hall?
I have a lot of affection for the Melbourne Town Hall, and the acoustics in there are good. And, you know, it's been wonderful to be in a hall in the middle of the city. You know, really smack bang in the middle. So that's a priceless asset.
Yeah, yeah.
I should also really stress that in the context of our hall being shut for 2 years, how lucky were we
to get a home? Yeah,
a home like Melbourne Town Hall. You know, with a good sized stage, with room for 1,800 audience. You know, we've been incredibly fortunate. But Melbourne Town Hall isn't a purpose built concert hall.
And I have to say, I really noticed the sound difference when I was there recently. I just found that the power of the orchestra, when they really want to belt it out, I didn't get. It was not dull, but just even rather than powerful.
And, you know, a large part of the budget on Hamer Hall has been on inside the hall and improving the acoustics and improving the facilities. And what a wonderful way to go back into the hall with our first concerts for a long time with Markus Stenz. So, you know, Markus, we miss him very much. And for him to come back with three different programs, and they're very ambitious programs, but, you know, the audience has a soft spot for Markus, and I know that they'll go with him. So the first one features Mahler's Third Symphony, the second one features Act One of Varga's Die Walküre, and then the third program builds on the project that Markus started while he was here, Act Three, the concept that at the end of the concert you'd get a little taster of something else and you wouldn't know what it was. Well, for Act Three, it's a whole concert that we're not announcing the program for, so the audience will come and not know what they're hearing.
But it will be in association with the Australian Youth Orchestra.
It will be, which is possibly an indication of the size of the works that we'll perform, but also an indication of, you know, that we're taking the opportunity with the opening of Hamer Hall to look forward, and positive collaboration with the younger musicians of today is part of that moving forward.
Your master's series is very popular. For 2012, what can we expect?
Well, what's slightly different in 2012 is our master's series across all 3 days are not identical. So Thursday nights, Friday nights and Saturday masters, they're all slightly different. But we have some really phenomenal artists appearing in 2012. I'm very proud of the season. Some returning favourites like Sir Andrew Davis, like Andrew Litton, Stephen Huff, the pianist. Then some artists, very important artists making their debuts, someone like Tugan Sokiev. He's a young Russian conductor, just been on Asian tour with the Vienna Philharmonic. Therefore, he might not be a name that people know at the moment, but he's certainly going to be a name that people are going to recognise. In fact, one of my favourite programmes for next year features the English conductor Bramwell Tovey, who is with us next week, in fact, performing Rhapsody in Blue and other Gershwin numbers as part of Pops. But he comes to do a programme which features Constant Lambert's piece, The Rio Grande, alongside William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast. I mean, that is going to be an oral orgy. I mean,
Absolutely.
It's a completely cataclysmic program. It would be wonderful.
I can't think of a better way to describe it.
I'm very proud that perhaps the world's greatest dramatic soprano, Deborah Voigt, will come and make her Australian debut with the MSO.
Wow.
In a program featuring Strauss, the final scene from Salome, and the Prelude and Liebestod from Tristan and Isolde. It really is a coup and a feather in the MSO's cap that she comes to perform solely with the MSO. Yeah, it's a great season. There is a lot of variety. There's definitely something for everyone. And then we've also got some really amazing commercial events in 2012. The one that's just created a public interest like we've potentially never seen before is this project that we do in a collaboration with the BBC. Again, it's a Melbourne exclusive, and it's music from the most recent series of Doctor Who. But also, right, as part of this, containers are coming out, the original Dalek costumes will be there, the Cybermen will be there. You're going to have monsters walking through the aisles of the Melbourne Convention and Exhibition Centre. It's going to be a different kind of concert experience.
Wow. And you said it's featuring the music from the most recent series.
So Murray Gold's
it's
Doctor
modern,
Who.
The modern pieces.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Fantastic. You'll also be doing a collaboration with the Bell Shakespeare Company.
Yeah, that's a project that we put together with John Bell. It's music, different music associated with Romeo and Juliet. So we've built it, I don't think unfairly, as saying it's the world's greatest love story. And so we will have actors from the Bell Shakespeare Company, four actors who will perform sections of Shakespeare's text. And the whole experience will be directed by John Bell. We will be using different spaces in Hamer Hall. And the music played will include music by Prokofiev, music by Tchaikovsky. It's going to be a really magical evening.
Now, we go national with the show, and you do a touring series that goes to regional areas. And, of course, you feature in Sydney as well. So
it is quite possible that we'll be featuring in Sydney next season. Keep your ears to the ground about that one. We hope to release information about that very soon.
And Geelong? What do you take to those regional centres?
We perform five concerts in Geelong every season. We were, in fact, in Geelong on Friday night just gone, and that was a programme where we had four soloists, visiting conductor, and our chorus taking them down to Geelong. So both in Geelong and at Robert Blackwood Hall in Monash, we are performing absolutely our core symphonic season there as well.
Now, you do a program called Ears Wide Open, which is an interactive journey through music. Tell us a little bit about that, because it features one of my favourites, Richard Gill.
Ears Wide Open is very much built around the communicative genius of Richard Gill and his ability to take works of music, deconstruct them from the audience, and put them back together again.
He has a unique way of doing it, too.
It is, and it's a charm as well in the way that he presents it. He is never confronting. He speaks to people of all ages, and that's a priceless ability. So three times next year we will take a piece of music that we're performing in our season, and Rich will perform a section of it with the MSO, and then start to talk about some of the maybe the compositional processes or what's happening elsewhere in the season and elsewhere in the movement, and then slowly put the piece back together. Richard has a particular genius in the way that he presents it.
Now, one of the world's greatest trumpeters is coming out, Chris Botti. So he's five times Grammy nominee.
Chris Botti is something actually of a phenomenon. And that's largely in the States. I mean, he is one of the hugest names. He played in Sting's band for a long time. He He did a concert with the Boston Symphony Orchestra that was recorded for DVD that just featured a complete array of the world's biggest stars, like classical players like Yo-Yo Ma, Bobby McFerrin, Sting himself. He came to the Melbourne Jazz Festival this year, did a show with his band in the Melbourne Recital Centre. So next year we're presenting him with full symphony orchestra in the State Theatre for two shows in our pop series. Boaty is... He will go ballistic in this country. He's quite something.
And one of the other things, I guess you call it your pop series, there is Symphonies of Legends. It's Video Games Unplugged. What is this about?
Well, you know, one of the art forms that youngsters today communicate most closely with, and one of their sources of music, is what they are hearing during their gaming time.
It's the backing track to their video games.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, these are often recorded by major orchestras. They're composed by, you know, really skilled and inspired composers in their own right. So this show is a show we put together with a gaming company in Japan, where most of the major hits are coming from. And it's going to feature brand new games, sort of classic games. It's going to have... video projections of games. There are a number of kind of interesting stars who are coming to be involved with the project. One we've recently confirmed is Will Wheaton. You might remember him from the film Stand By Me, but he's sort of an icon in the gaming world, particularly in the States. And so it's something different. It's not necessary for our Master Series subscribers, but there is definitely an audience for this in Melbourne.
Yeah, and again, I think it takes the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra two things. Back to its roots, which, let's face it, when it started out, it was a backing band for the ABC.
Mm-hmm. Not actually in its first roots, because we are 100 years old, but
indeed,
as part of its history.
Indeed, and it's now very much a standalone organisation, separated from the ABC, that it has to sustain its own...
Absolutely, although we do really enjoy a very close relationship with the ABC. Our offices are still in ABC South Bank. All of our concerts are broadcast on the ABC. ABC engineers and producers work with us on all of our recordings. You know, it's a very close relationship that we are privileged to enjoy.
Indeed, but you must, you can't rely on the ABC anymore. You have to be self-sustaining as an organisation, and well, that's the model.
Absolutely, and our relationship with the ABC kind of involves give and take, you know,
yeah,
as well.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And so they enjoy the relationship with us as much.
Hugh Humphreys, it is an extraordinary program for 2012. Melbourne Symphony Orchestra's 2012 season really does have something for everybody. It has something for all ages and all tastes. And it is a credit to you, sir, for putting such an extraordinary program together.
Thank you, Dean. I mean, it's a privilege to program for this city. I think one of the great things about the MSO, I'm a Londoner, and London is a city of... you know, six or seven orchestras. As a result, you don't feel necessarily that any of those orchestras is that city's orchestra. And I really feel that responsibility and that honour in my job. That
it's a huge burden to carry, though, because there's a lot of expectation that comes
absolutely.
With that job. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, that means that people, if they're interested in orchestral music, they're going to be MSO subscribers or regular attenders at the MSO, and you know that's wonderful.
All power to you. Tell us a little bit about that secret program again that you were mentioning earlier.
It's called Secret Symphony. Information is slowly being drip-fed over Twitter and Facebook, so anyone with internet access can find out about it. The first concert is not far away, but because it's a secret, Dean, if I told you what it was, I'd have to kill you, I'm afraid.
Hugh Humphreys is the Director of Artistic Planning for Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. The 2012 season has been launched. You can find out more information.
And just one thing I wanted to add, we've also just recently put a third show of The Messiah on sale at the Melbourne Recital Centre in December. We perform The Messiah every year. It's one of our great highlights. And we'll be performing three shows at the MRC in December this year.
Hugh Humphreys joining us from Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. Check out mso.com.au for more information. And if you would like to get a podcast or a transcript of this program, it's available for download from Joy's website, joy.org.au. I'm Dean Beck. Till next time, you keep well, take care. We'll see you again next week. Bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Brierley from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
Service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.